This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Paula Simchak. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Sunday, July 26, 2026 edition of the Milford Daily News. In May, State Trooper Kevin Trainer was killed by a wrong-way driver on Route 1 in Linfield. He was just one victim in a growing number of fatal wrong-way crashes in Massachusetts, according to data from the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. Now, a new law seeks to prevent more of these accidents from happening in the future. On July 9th, Governor Maura Healey signed into law wrong-way driving legislation as part of the fiscal year 2027 budget. Originally, amendment filed by Senator Bruce Tarr, Republican Gloucester, the legislation establishes a wrong-way driving prevention strategy, implements roadway safety improvements, and identifies high-risk locations. It's the culmination of a year of work Tarr has been doing since Endicott College Police Department Sergeant Jeremy Cole and 18-year-old Christopher Daly died in wrong-way driving collisions in 2024 and 2025, respectively, according to a press release from Tarr's office. The deaths of Christopher Daly, Sergeant Jeremy Cole, Trooper Kevin Trainer, and every life lost to wrong-way driving represent heartbreaking tragedies for their families, friends, and communities, Tarr, Republican Gloucester, said in a statement July 23rd. The best way we can honor their memory and protect everyone who travels on our roadways is by doing everything possible to prevent these crashes before they happen. The new law seeks to prevent wrong-way driving through safety improvements, educational campaigns, and new technology. Here are some of the steps it takes. It establishes a data-driven wrong-way driving prevention strategy for all limited-access roadways or highways with limited entry and exit points. It implements roadway safety improvements, including directional striping on highway ramps, enhanced signage, improved roadway lighting, and real-time wrong-way driver detection systems. It incorporates wrong-way driving prevention education into driver training programs. It requires annual wrong-way driving public awareness campaigns through the Registry of Motor Vehicles. It mandates wrong-way driving instruction and law enforcement officer training, and it directs a feasibility study on improving roadway safety for drivers over 70. The plan requires that implementation prioritize high-risk locations, which are determined based on data on wrong-way driving incidences and roadway deficiencies. It also calls for annual reporting to the legislature on implementation progress, costs, and effectiveness. Every life lost to a wrong-way driver is a heartbreaking tragedy that reminds us why we must do everything we can to make our roads safer, Healey said in a statement. Together, we're taking meaningful action to save lives and prevent more families from experiencing these heartbreaking losses. For anyone who has considered owning a private island and has the means to make it happen, this is your chance. A remarkable property in Cadamet, a village in Bern, has come on the market offering idyllic sea views, plenty of room for gracious living entertainment, privacy, and a sense of peace. Located at 75 Windsor Road, the property, called Rocky Island, overlooks Redbrook Harbor and is accessible by vehicles via a short wooden bridge. The 2.82-acre parcel's sole house is a classic shingle-style cape built in 1891. The home covers 6,839 square feet and features 17 rooms, including 7 bedrooms, 7 full baths, and a wraparound veranda. Rocky Island has a listing price of $10.9 million. There's a special feeling about living on an island, and yet there is a convenience of being attached to the mainland, said Stuart Young of Landvest and the property's listing agent. The house underwent very top-of-the-line renovations while retaining many elements of the original house. The island is a haven for naturalists, as it contains mature trees, windswept grass, and a sandy beach that nearly circles the entire property. The current property owners, who wish to remain anonymous, previously lived nearby for several years, admiring the house when passing it in their boat. Antique homes have always been a passion for us, and this one offers historic charm, unparalleled 360-degree views, and an expansive layout that makes it a perfect gathering place for friends and family, they said in an emailed statement. A seasonal deep-water dock is perfect for the mariner or for laying out and catching some rays. A heated saltwater swimming pool and a garage-slash-pool house add an extra touch. Step inside the house, and it's just as lovely, with natural light spilling in through the windows and the sounds of the ocean just beyond. The home had beautiful bones, but was in need of some major attention, its owner said. transforming the breezeway into a chef-worthy kitchen with handmade cabinets, marble countertops, top-of-the-line appliances, and an adjacent butler's pantry was essential to our vision of creating a home well-suited to large family gatherings and entertaining, the owners said in their statement. In addition, each bathroom has been fully upgraded with marble tile, nickel features, and a cast-iron clawfoot tubs, mirroring the charm of the original build. Other upgrades made to create a cozy nest for both winter and summer alike include adding hot water, the HVAC system, fiber optic cable, and natural gas for heating the house and swimming pool. Island Living has something for everyone. For the current owners, it's the dining room, which comfortably seats 20, has stunning ocean views, and is all about creating memories. In the daytime, we and our guests enjoy watching the sailboats pass by, and in the evenings are treated to a front row seat for kaleidoscopic sunsets, summer lightning storms, and 4th of July fireworks, the owner said. The room is just as well suited to game nights or gathering over a puzzle. Young appreciates that each bedroom has a beautiful water view. Outside, as an island, everywhere you look is stunning, but I particularly like the northern sheltered side of the island with large, ever-changing tidal pool, Young said. How many ways can you say special? This one-of-a-kind property is available because its owners now wish to downsize. While we are sad to leave Rocky Island, we have memories for a lifetime and know that the next owners will create their own beautiful memories here too, they said. Rentschler Biopharma SE, a global contract development and manufacturing organization for biopharmaceuticals that has its U.S. headquarters in Milford, has announced the appointment of Torsten Wuhr as Chief Executive Officer, effective August 1st. Wuhr brings more than 25 years of experience across the international contract manufacturing and biotechnology industries. He was most recently Chief Commercial Officer of Bechem Group, where he led global commercial activities that drove major strategic investments with a focus on sustainable growth. He holds a doctorate in bioorganic chemistry from the University/Federal Institute of Technology, EPFL, in Lausanne. In early 2020, German-based Rentschler Biopharma secured a $1.2 million tax break to build a two-story large-scale manufacturing facility at 27 Maple Street in Milford. Natick-based Middlesex Savings Bank, one of the largest mutual banks in Massachusetts, announced a recent hiring and promotion. Kirsten Madsen has been hired as Senior Vice President, Director of Cash Management and Payment Services. She brings more than 15 years of financial services experience. Her most recent stint was as Vice President of Consumer Bank Territory Operations at Flagstar Bank, where she led the operations and risk oversight for approximately 150 retail branches in three states. Prior to that, Madsen spent 10 years with Bank of America, where she oversaw the implementation and servicing of treasury products for enterprise clients. Brian Hanley has been promoted to Senior Vice President, Director of Business Banking. His promotion builds on a 30-year career in banking. He was previously Senior Vice President, Business Banking Team Leader at Middlesex Savings Bank for 17 years. In that role, he managed a portfolio of commercial loan relationships while overseeing a team of lenders, responsibilities which he will continue at a higher level as part of his new position. He spent 5 years as a Senior Vice President of Retail Banking at Strata Bank before it merged with Middlesex Savings Bank in 2009. Founded in 1835, Middlesex Savings Bank boasts more than $6 billion in assets. Robin Peterson has been promoted to Assistant Vice President, Learning and Development Administrator at Mutual One Bank, which has operations in Framingham and Natick. She has been with the bank since 2024, starting as an Assistant Vice President, floating branch manager and administrator, and brings more than 15 years of experience in the financial industry. Peterson holds a degree in business administration from Northeastern University and a certificate in dynamics of management from Baypath University. In 2022, a Maynard woman almost lost $10,000 to Bitcoin scammers through a crypto ATM. In 2025, police saved a woman from losing $20,000 in another Bitcoin ATM scam in Lakeville. In these cases, the victims had been contacted by scammers posing as authority figures who invented emergencies and told them to immediately send money through a crypto ATM. But once the money is transferred in one of these machines, the chances of getting it back are near zero. In the past 5 years, these scams have skyrocketed, according to a press release from the office of Senator John Cronin, Democrat Fitchburg. In the last year alone, Massachusetts residents have lost nearly $7 million to crypto ATM scams, according to ARP. Some seniors have lost their entire life savings. Now, lawmakers are trying to prevent future victims by cracking down on the machines themselves. Early on July 24th, the Massachusetts Senate passed legislation to ban crypto ATM kiosks in Massachusetts as part of its economic development bill. I was proud to pass the amendment that bans crypto ATM kiosks, but more importantly, that saves people in the Commonwealth from future predatory scams, Cronin, who filed the amendment, said in a statement. This amendment is a strong consumer protection measure that recognizes the unique dangers posed by these machines. It recognizes that regulation is not enough when the risk is the machine itself. And it recognizes that the Commonwealth has a responsibility to act before more residents lose their savings, their homes, and their financial security. The amendment bans virtual currency kiosks from operating in Massachusetts. Virtual currency kiosks, or crypto ATMs, are physical kiosks that convert cash into cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. While they look like traditional ATMs and are similarly often located in convenience stores, they do not connect to a bank account and instead link directly to a digital wallet to transfer digital assets, according to Cronin's office. The amendment gives the Attorney General the authority to bring a civil action against anyone who operates a crypto ATM in the state. The crypto ATM ban was not included in the House's version of the Economic Development Bill, so the two chambers will have to come to an agreement in conference committees before it can go to Governor Maura Healey's desk. Four states, including Vermont, have already passed bans on crypto ATMs, as have a few towns in Massachusetts. Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell issued a statement supporting the legislation, saying it will strengthen consumer safeguards and protect residents from harm. Campbell has already worked to crack down on crypto ATMs in the state. In February, her office sued cryptocurrency kiosk operator Bitcoin Depot for facilitating scams, causing them to close all their locations in Massachusetts. A recovery operation was underway Sunday, July 26th, after a swimmer is presumed to have drowned the previous day at a quarry in Milford, according to reports. Emergency crews responded to the area behind Shadowbrook Lane at about 2 p.m. Saturday following a report of a missing swimmer, according to WCVB-TV. Up to 50 first responders, comprised of three dive teams, firefighters, and police officers, are working to try to find the swimmer, the television station reported. The news comes less than a week after a woman trying to jump between two rocks on Sunday evening, July 19th, at the same quarry, didn't make it and fell about 10 feet. Fire Chief Mark Nelson told the Daily News that firefighters had to use a UTV to get the woman from the wooded area. Milford Police Chief Ticino said the woman suffered head and leg injuries. Nelson added that on July 4th, someone trying to jump off a cliff into the water didn't jump far enough and hit rocks on the way down. He said the area has always attracted swimmers who don't realize how dangerous the area is. People want to access it because of the heat, and it looks like a recreation area, but it's not, Nelson said Monday, July 20th. It's a dangerous area, and there's a lot of jagged rocks in the water. On Tuesday, Milford Police urged residents in a Facebook post to avoid quarries. The steep rock faces, unstable terrain, and limited access for emergency responders create an extremely dangerous environment where a single misstep can have life-altering consequences for civilians and responders, police said in their post. Excited to try new restaurants around Boston this summer, but don't want to pay the price? Get excited. Dine Out Boston is almost here. Presented by Meet Boston, the Massachusetts Office of Travel and Tourism, and new sponsor Toast, the semi-annual culinary celebration, formerly known as Restaurant Week Boston, invites diners to experience the city's vibrant, diverse restaurant scene at a fraction of the normal dining cost. Boston's culinary scene is receiving the recognition it deserves. We are a premier dining destination, and we want residents and visitors alike to experience it through our Dine Out Boston program, said Martha J. Sheridan, president and CEO of Meet Boston, in a press release. Dine Out Boston is perfect for a family excursion, date night, or a gathering with friends or colleagues. Diners can explore specially priced menus at restaurants across Greater Boston with a wide range of cuisines to choose from throughout all 23 Boston neighborhoods, Cambridge, Somerville, Brookline, and beyond. Dine Out Boston's Summer 2026 program will last for 2 weeks, from Saturday, August 1st through Saturday, August 15th. During the two-week period, participating restaurants will offer a fixed-price menu with as many courses as they desire. Each restaurant selects one of three price points, offering lunch at $27, $32, or $36, and dinner at $38, $46, or $55. You do not need an admission ticket to attend Dine Out Boston. Simply show up at a participating restaurant and ask for the Dine Out Boston menu. Due to popularity, Meet Boston strongly encourages reservations, which can be made on Meat Boston's website or through the individual restaurant. Many restaurants also offer takeout and delivery options, but be sure to check with the individual restaurant beforehand. New this summer, Meat Boston is introducing the Dine Out Boston Bandwago Pass, a free browser-based mobile passport that allows diners to check in at participating restaurants, redeem special offers, and earn prizes while eating around Greater Boston. This summer, Dine Out Boston has partnered with nearly 200 restaurants in the Greater Boston area, including Boston neighborhoods like Chinatown, Seaport, and the North End, as well as suburbs like Cambridge and Somerville. Included restaurants are both widely beloved and highly rated, with several Michelin-recognized establishments on the list. This year, the program will also feature many first-time Dine Out Boston participants, like Rosa y Marigold, Maple and Ash, F1 Arcade, Fallow Kin, and all five Fuji locations. Options include all types of cuisine, including everything from historic Boston seafood spots to upscale French bistros. The full list of restaurants can be found on Meat Boston's website. While there are plenty of options for vegetarians, for vegan or gluten-free diets, it is recommended to check with the individual restaurant. Each Dine Out Boston session includes a charitable auction component, and this summer, Dine Out Boston proceeds will benefit the Blue Hill Observatory and Science Center, the Revere Beach Partnership, and the Veronica Robles Cultural Center. Diners are encouraged to bid on $100 certificates to participating restaurants at dobauction.com. Scott Van Ralton, Hopkinton's interim police chief, told select board members during their July 21 meeting that the police department has been using two Flock Safety license plate reader cameras for about 4 months and plans to acquire two more of the devices. He said civil forfeiture money was used to pay for the cameras. The select board had invited Van Ralton to discuss the cameras, which had been a source of controversy in other communities because board members had not known until recently that the police department was using them. Flock has come under attack from those who are worried about the storage and collection of information and what the company will do with the data, including whether it will provide information to federal immigration and customs enforcement agents. Hopkinton police have a strict usage policy, Van Ralton told the board. He said officers must state specific reasons why they're actually looking at footage and that it's audited frequently. He compared it to EasyPass on the Massachusetts Turnpike. He said the cameras only record license plates and other information about the vehicle, but not drivers or passengers. Van Ralton also said data is only shared with police departments in Massachusetts that also have contracts with Flock. He said Hopkinton does not share with private entities, federal agencies, or out-of-state departments. We could have reached the same conclusion during investigations without using the Flock system, but it saved us hundreds of hours of investigative work to get to that result, Van Ralton said. I've always looked at this as an investigative tool. The Framingham Police Department recently allowed its contract with Flock to expire and to have the Flock cameras removed as the city was working on a license plate reader policy. And earlier this year, the Natick Select Board, citing privacy and data sharing concerns, voted to have its police department leave the program and have the cameras removed. Hopkinton Select Board member Amy Ritterbush said it came as a surprise to all of us to learn that Hopkinton police were using Flock. She acknowledged there are many good uses, but there's also community concern. Board member Matt Kisner said the use of Flock cameras should be discussed. I'm really concerned about loss of autonomy and privacy this represents in the community, he said. There is a reasonable expectation that I can walk around this town, and when I'm not committing a crime, I exist anonymously. I don't think that's something I should have to request, and I think we're dangerously at risk for taking for granted. Kisner said his concern has nothing to do with Hopkinton Police, but rather Flock, which he termed an evil AI data company. Lack of trust in Flock is not lack of trust in HPD, he said. Board Chairman Shahidul Manan said he appreciates Van Ralton's explanation, as well as the potential uses for Flock, but he'd like to have the town attorney review the contract. We want to make sure we do not interfere with individuals' privacy, liberty, and individuals' security and preferences in any way, he said. The board did not take any vote about the Flock cameras, nor did it indicate it would do so in the future. However, members did say they would like more information at a later meeting. In a statement on Wednesday, Van Ralton reiterated the measures the department is taking to make sure the information is not misused. He assured the public that all data and privacy information is being kept confidential. The Hopkinton Police Department pledges to protect our residents' and visitors' privacy while ensuring that our community is safe and protected by every possible means, the interim chief said in his statement. As a modern law enforcement agency, it is vital that the HPD keeps pace with technology and provides our investigators with the tools they need to keep this community safe. Framingham officials outlined a plan in which they intend to reorganize several city departments as part of an effort to trim spending and streamline operations after a challenging budget season. During a city council meeting on July 21st, Mayor Charlie Sisitsky described his plan for fiscal 2027, for which the Callahan Center is under the purview of the library director, and that the Division of Parks and Recreation is merged with that of Capital Projects and Facilities Management. With the restructuring, the city would have a new Library and Community Services Division and a new Capital Projects and Facilities Management and Parks and Recreation Division, each led by a single division head. The city has eliminated the district positions for both the Callahan Center and the former Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Affairs Division. City officials estimate these changes will save about $270,000 annually, depending on the final job descriptions and salaries under the reorganization. The approved fiscal 2027 budget reflects those savings. During the July 21 council meeting, Sisitsky said the restructuring is designed to improve efficiency while preserving services. It will not impact public interfacing services provided by any division or department, the mayor said. All public interfacing services provided by both divisions will remain intact. Noelia Valdez, Assistant Director of Elder Services, told the Daily News in an email that the changes create opportunities for greater collaboration between the Callahan Center and the library, and that the focus remains on supporting residents 55 and over. We hope to strengthen programs and services, share expertise, and create additional opportunities for the seniors we serve, she said. During Tuesday's public hearing, counselors were generally supportive of the reorganization, with many saying it was creative and allowed for services to be more efficient. I applaud you for making courageous decisions, District 4 City Council Michael Cannon said to Sisitsky during the meeting. I think this makes huge strides in the right direction. Other residents offered a mix of support and concern. Steve Kiviat, a board member of the Friends of Callahan, a nonprofit that raises money to support Framingham Senior Services, said during the meeting that he is encouraged by the current staff at the Callahan Center and supports the proposed reorganization. The proposal to reorganize the library in the Callahan Center is very forward-thinking, and it looks to the future of the Framingham seniors, he said. But Heather Klisch, chair of the Board of Library Trustees, read a statement indicating the group worries about the scope of responsibilities that would fall to Library Director Don DeLaSanta if the plan is approved. The board is concerned that a single individual will be expected to fulfill the responsibilities of two full-time leadership positions through the role of Library and Community Services Division Head, Klisch said. While day-to-day responsibilities can be delegated, executive leadership and accountability cannot. Concerns about funding and support for senior services were also raised during the discussion after the director position was cut. District 2 Councilor Brandon Ward asked about the city's use of the state formula grant for senior services, a topic previously mentioned by District 3 Councilor Mary Kate Feeney during budget discussions. The grant program provides $16 per resident age 60 and older and can be used to support services for seniors. The city has a senior population of 16,026. Chief Financial Officer Brian Turbitt said during the July 21 meeting that the city currently has about $630,000 from the grant, prompting questions from several councilors about how the money has been spent. Feeney told the Daily News that annual funding has increased significantly, rising from around $154,000 in 2021 to more than $256,000 in 2026. She attributed the increase to both a higher per-resident allocation from the state and growth in Framingham's senior population. She also emphasized the importance in having a dedicated leader focused on senior issues. Really, why I think this position, Callahan Senior Center Director, is important is because it gives the voice for our seniors in government, Feeney said. They are the advocate for seniors. They are the boots on the ground working on programs, education, and grants. Feeney said she hopes the Council on Aging plays a larger role in future funding discussions. Councilors voted 7-4 to create a 3-member ad hoc committee to discuss the proposal, including job descriptions and salaries. The committee is expected to report back to the full council on August 18th. Under the city charter, the council has 60 days to approve or reject the proposal as submitted. Councilors can only cast a yes or no vote. They cannot amend the plan. Singer and songwriter John Waterman is bringing The Railroad and Song, a program combines traditional and original music with stories and a slideshow focused on trains, railroad workers, train wrecks, heroes, and hobos, to Framingham next month, according to a community announcement. Waterman will perform at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, August 11th at the Callahan Center, 535 Union Avenue in Framingham. Admission is free. Waterman's presentation is part of a broader series called Live Music Making History Live, according to the announcement. The series is designed to encourage people to explore and celebrate history through music. The August 11th event will feature songs and storytelling tied to railroad history, along with visual elements that help illustrate the experiences of people connected to the rail industry. Support for the program comes in part from a grant provided through the Framingham Cultural Council, a local agency supported by the Mass Cultural Council. Framingham Youth Theater, which describes itself as an inclusive and immersive arts experience for Framingham Public School students entering grades 1 through 8, will wrap up its four-week summer program by performing Shrek Jr. at 6 p.m. on Thursday, July 30th, and at 1 p.m. on Friday, July 31st, both at Cameron Middle School, located at 215 Elm Street. This year's program drew more than 70 students, according to Carly Fallon, an advisor for the group. In addition, she said many counselors and assistants are current Framingham High School students, or recent graduates. Two current counselors were campers during the program's first season in 2018. The production is about much more than putting on a musical, Fallon said in an email about the program. Our program has grown into a space where young people build confidence, friendships, and a sense of belonging through the performing arts. She said all of Framingham's elementary and middle schools, including the McAuliffe Charter School, are represented among this summer's participants. The Framingham Youth Theater Summer Program is designed for performers of all levels with an interest in theater arts. Educators from Framingham High School's Fine and Performing Arts Department provide instruction in acting, dance, voice, and stagecraft. Bus transportation and meals are offered. When Dr. Jill Biden, the former First Lady of the United States, took a flight to Nantucket last week, Cape Air chose a special aircraft for her trip. On Friday, July 17th, Biden flew with her daughter, Ashley, from Martha's Vineyard to Nantucket on the airline's new America 250 livery plane, which Cape Air had specifically selected for the flight. The aircraft features a bold red, white, and blue design with the phrase, "We the People," on the underbelly. When the airplane received information that the former First Lady was going to be a passenger on the flight, officials knew they needed to send a very special livery to complete the flight, Cape Air said in a statement. So they sent the America 250 plane to greet her. Biden posed for a photo with the aircraft before the flight at Martha's Vineyard Airport, according to the airline. When she saw the plane and learned that the belly contained the words, "We the People," she immediately exclaimed, "I love it," Cape Air said. The airline unveiled the painted Cessna 402C aircraft on July 3rd to celebrate the United States' semi-quincentennial. The design touts stars and stripes inspired by the American flag and a bald eagle on the tail, along with other patriotic details. The America 250 livery flies throughout Cape Air's regional network, the airline said. Biden served as First Lady from 2021 to 2025, while her husband, former President Joe Biden, was in office. The Bidens have been known to visit Nantucket over the years, including for their annual Thanksgiving trips to the island dating back to 1975. The former president has been spotted attending local Christmas tree lighting ceremonies and strolling through town with his children and grandchildren. Your next CVS run could involve picking up medications for your puppy, alongside your own prescriptions. In a July 21 announcement, CVS said its pharmacies would begin filling prescriptions for select pet medications, including antibiotics, allergy medications, flea and tick control, insulin, and pain relievers. The wound socket-based company said the service is now available for dogs and cats at all 9,000 stores nationwide. With the addition of pet medication dispensing, CVS Pharmacy can now serve every member of the family, said Sid Tanetti, Senior Vice President and Interim President of Pharmacy and Consumer Wellness at CVS Health. The pharmacy giant joins other major chains, including Walmart and Walgreens, in the pet prescription medication market. CVS also said it recently added pet essentials from several brands, including Milk-Bone, Greenies, Churu, Savory Prime, and Temptations, to its store shelves. Pet owners who want to have their pet's prescription filled at CVS can either bring a written prescription to the pharmacy or ask their veterinarian to contact CVS directly, the company said. Once CVS receives a prescription, the owner can then choose to pick up the medication in-store or have it delivered, if eligible. Customers can also add their pets to their CVS.com profile and manage eligible pet prescriptions through the CVS Health app, the company said. The pharmacy said it expects to be able to accept electronic prescriptions for pet medications starting later this year. Select prescription medications for dogs and cats are now available at CVS, the company said, including the following. For allergic dermatitis, ocrelizumab meleate, or Apoquel, ilunocitinib, or Zenrelia. In antibiotics, enrofloxacin, or Baytril. In anticonvulsants, levetiracetam ER, or levetiracetam, or zonisamide. In anti-inflammatories and pain relief, meloxicam, which is Medicam, firoxacib, which is Prevacox, carprofen, which is Rimadyl, diracoxib, which is Deramax, and grepiprant, which is Galliprant. In anxiolytic behavior modification, fluoxetine HCL and trazodone HCL. For cardiovascular needs, amlodipine besylate, benazepril HCL, enalapril maleate MAL, furosemide, and pimobendan, which is vetmedin. For diabetes, protamine zinc insulin, which is Prozinc, and velagliflozin, which is Senvelgo. For flea and ticks, efoxolaner, which is Nexgard, serolaner, which is Simparica, lotilaner, which is Credelio, and lotilaner, which is Credelio CAT. For heartworm prevention / external and internal parasite control, lotilaner, moxidectin, prasantiquol, pyrantel, which is Credelio Quattro, isofoxilaner, epirinomectin, preziquantel, which is Nexgard combo, efoxilaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel, which is Nexgard plus, salimectin, and serolaner, which is Revolution plus, serolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel, which is Simparica trio, and milbemycin oxime, spinosad, which is Trifexis. For heartworm prevention / internal parasite control, ivermectin, pyrantel, which is HeartGuard plus, milbemycin oxime, which is Interceptor, milbemycin oxime, preziquantel, which is Interceptor plus, and other medications such as meropitant citrate, which is Serenia, prednisone, and ursodiol. A jury has been seated in the trial of Lindsay Clancy, the Duxbury mother charged with murder in the January 2023 deaths of her three children. The completion of jury selection clears the way for opening statements, which will take place Monday, July 27th. At the close of Wednesday, 10 women and 7 men had been seated to the 18-member jury, but on Thursday, 2 of the previously seated jurors were excused. In the ensuing hours, 3 additional women were selected to the jury, which now consists of 12 women and 6 men. 6 of the 18 will serve as alternates, while 12 will deliberate on a verdict once both sides rest their cases. Clancy is charged with 3 counts of murder in the January 2023 deaths of her 3 small children in their Duxbury home. The prosecution says she planned the act, sending her husband, Patrick Clancy, out of the house on errands before strangling the children to death with exercise bands. Clancy then cut her wrists and neck before jumping from a second-story window, leaving her paralyzed below the sternum, court documents say. Clancy's defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, argues that Clancy is not criminally responsible, the so-called insanity plea. Postpartum depression, coupled with over-medication, led to a psychotic break, Reddington has said in pretrial hearings. The judge presiding over the Lindsay Clancy murder trial has prohibited the media from recording and disseminating certain sensitive pieces of evidence. Patrick Clancy, Lindsay's ex-husband, and the father of their 3 deceased children, filed a motion to restrict media display and dissemination of evidence that the prosecution will present at trial in Plymouth Superior Court in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Autopsy photographs of the children, an agonizing 911 call made by Patrick Clancy, in which he discovers his children unresponsive in the basement of the family's Duxbury home. Judge William Sullivan allowed the motion on Friday, July 24th. Reporters and members of the public present in the courtroom will be allowed to view and listen to the evidence and discuss it in their reporting, per the judge's order. Patrick Clancy had also asked that the media not distribute photos of the clothing worn by the children at the time of their deaths, but the judge did not include that in his ruling. Lindsay Clancy is charged with 3 counts of murder in the strangulation deaths of her 3 small children, Cora, age 5, Dawson, age 3, and Callan, 8 months, in January 2024. Clancy does not dispute that she killed them, but denies criminal responsibility due to undiagnosed postpartum depression and the effects of overmedication. Opening arguments in the high-profile case begin Monday, July 27th at Plymouth Superior Court. A Hopedale man accused of sexually assaulting two teenage boys while he was a nurse at Boston Children's Hospital is scheduled to be arraigned Monday, July 27th in Suffolk Superior Court. In a press release made available on Friday, July 24th, Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden said John Tam, age 33, is charged with four counts each of indecent assault and battery on a person older than 14, and indecent assault and battery on a patient by a health care provider. A Suffolk County grand jury indicted Tam earlier this month. Tam previously worked at UMass Memorial Medical Center in Marlborough and Worcester, as well as at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Hayden urged parents whose children may have been treated by Tam to contact authorities if they believe they've been victimized. In a statement, Boston Children's Hospital said it is fully cooperating with the investigation. At Boston Children's Hospital, our patients and their families' safety and well-being are our utmost priority, and we continue to cooperate with the investigation and prosecution, the statement reads. A spokeswoman for UMass Memorial said that due to pending litigation, the hospital could not comment. In his press release, Hayden said prosecutors are concerned that there may be more victims. We are concerned that these may not be isolated incidents, and we want to assure our parents that any information they provide will be thoroughly and sensitively investigated, the district attorney said. According to the release, the first incident occurred on September 19, 2022. A 15-year-old boy had chest surgery and had been administered anesthesia. When the boy woke up, he discovered Tam, his nurse, was inappropriately touching his genitals. The second alleged incident occurred on January 2, 2025. According to the release, the second victim, whose age was not disclosed, had surgery and was under anesthesia. After the surgery, Tam told the boy's mother to get her car and bring it to an entrance so the boy could be discharged. While the mother was gone, Tam dressed the boy, led him to a single-stall bathroom, and then allegedly sexually assaulted the boy for 8 minutes, including fondling his genitals and offering to show him pornography on his phone. When the mother discovered what had occurred, she immediately told hospital staff, who contacted Boston police. Police reviewed security footage and allegedly showed Tam wheeling the boy into a bathroom and exiting the bathroom 9 minutes later. The public is invited to take part in This Is Your Plaza, a free multicultural event that will transform Framingham's Nevins Hall into a community gathering space inspired by public squares from throughout the world, according to a community announcement. The event will be held from 1 to 5 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, August 15th and 16th, at the Memorial Building at 150 Concord Street. The two-day celebration, presented in partnership with the City of Framingham and the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, invites people of all ages and backgrounds to celebrate the city's diversity while sharing ideas about the future of one of Framingham's civic landmarks, according to a community announcement. Visitors can enjoy free tacos from The Taco Dude, ice cream from Eastley Farm, music from around the world, family crafts, giant coloring activities, dominoes, Loteria Mexicana, origami, and interactive community art installations. Complimentary food will be available while supplies last, according to the announcement. The event will reimagine Nevins Hall as a place where neighbors gather, children play, and community connections grow. Through interactive activities designed for all ages, participants will be encouraged to share stories, memories, traditions, favorite places in Framingham, and ideas for the city's future. This project is about creating a welcoming place where everyone feels they belong, said artist Claudia Ruiz Gustafson, who was selected by the MAPC to lead the creative placemaking engagement for the Framingham Arts and Culture Vision Plan. Whether your family has lived in Framingham for generations or you arrived last month, your experiences and ideas matter. The event is part of the Framingham Arts and Culture Vision Plan, an initiative led by the city and the MAPC to explore how arts, culture, and creative placemaking can strengthen community life. Organizers say the stories, conversations, and ideas shared during the event will help shape recommendations for the future use of historic Nevins Hall and the community center while contributing to a broader vision for arts and culture in Framingham. Multilingual outreach and activities are planned to help welcome residents from Framingham's diverse communities. A Framingham man who has served nearly 30 years in prison for killing a 17-year-old girl will soon be set free. The State Parole Board on Thursday, July 23rd, announced that it has granted parole to Damian Lockhart, age 52, who was convicted in the August 10, 1996 murder of Kimberly Bolton. He pleaded guilty in 1997 to second-degree murder, which made him eligible for parole after 20 years. The decision is a blow to Bolton's family, according to her aunt, Carol Aitken Young. "We're so devastated about it," Aitken Young said when contacted on Thursday. "He serves 30 years, and they let him out? Kimberly doesn't get a second chance." On the day of the slaying, Lockhart was angry and high on drugs after an argument with his girlfriend, according to a statement of facts in the case. He met up with Bolton, who was 5 years younger, but whom he knew as an acquaintance. Lockhart brought the girl to an area near the Waverly Street train station known as the Weeds and attempted to have sex with her. When she rejected him, he attempted to rape her. When she fought back, Lockhart beat her to death with a large rock. Lockhart had previously sought parole 4 times but was denied. But last year, the parole board deadlocked 3-3 on his 4th parole bid because it was down a member. Due to that, Lockhart was eligible to request parole again this year. In March, during his latest parole hearing, Lockhart apologized to Bolton's family and took responsibility for her death. He also said he participated in many programs while in prison, including one on empathy and another on victim awareness. Lockhart said that when he was younger, he had a problem handling rejection, and when Bolton rejected him soon after his argument with his girlfriend, he snapped. Several members of Bolton's family testified during the March hearing, urging the parole board to deny Lockhart's bid for freedom. On Thursday, Aiken Young said she felt as if the parole board ignored their concerns. "I don't know what to do. There's nothing to do," she said. "When we went to the parole board, we said everything we had to say. We did as much as we could. We fought." In its decision, the parole board said Lockhart had followed the recommendations made during past parole hearings on what programs and courses to take. It also noted that Lockhart is in a wheelchair due to spinal and hip issues. The testimony of a psychiatrist who expressed belief that Lockhart was a good candidate for release was also a strong consideration, the board said. Mr. Lockhart has family and friend support and a reentry plan to meet his needs, according to the parole board's written decision. The board concludes Mr. Lockhart has demonstrated a level of rehabilitation that would make his release compatible with the welfare of society. Prior to release, Lockhart must serve 90 days in a minimum security facility and then enter a residential or a community resources for justice program. He must remain alcohol and drug-free, be home between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., and have no contact with Bolton's family or the victims of an unrelated unarmed robbery for which he was previously convicted. Aitken Young said, "It's not enough. It's just not fair," she said. "Kimberly doesn't get a second chance. She doesn't get a second chance to be free. It's not fair. She doesn't get a second chance at life." Steve Kerrigan, the chairman of the Massachusetts Democratic Party, was charged with drunken driving last month as a result of a June 13th traffic stop in Southborough. On June 15th in Westborough District Court, sufficient facts were found on the driving under the influence of alcohol charge. The case was continued without a finding for 1 year, and Kerrigan lost his license for 45 days. According to the statement of facts written by Southborough police officer Panagiotis Samarksi, Kerrigan, 54, of Lancaster, was driving his gray 2017 BMW SUV in the middle of both lanes on Turnpike Road, Route 9, while traveling westbound. When stopped around midnight June 13th, Kerrigan, the sole occupant of the vehicle, told the officer he was going home from a restaurant. As Samarksi was speaking to Kerrigan, his eyes appeared to be glassy and bloodshot red, while his speech appeared to be slow, thick-tongued, and slurred, according to the statement of facts. When asked how much alcohol he drank that night, Kerrigan told the officer he only had 2 beers around 6 p.m. and then went to dinner. Around 1 a.m., Kerrigan provided a sample for a blood alcohol content test, which measured 0.089%, while a second sample taken 3 minutes later measured at 0.086%, both above the 0.08% legal blood alcohol concentration limit for drivers. A charge of negligent operation of a motor vehicle was dismissed, while Kerrigan was found not responsible for a marked lane violation. On July 23rd, Kerrigan's attorney, Andrea Levy, forwarded the Telegram and Gazette a comment on behalf of her client. "In June, I was pulled over for a marked lane violation and blew 0.089 on the breathalyzer," Kerrigan said. "I regret and take full responsibility for my actions and their consequences, and appreciate the Southborough Police Department and the Westborough Court for their professionalism and service." A spokesperson for the State Democratic Party declined to comment. A native of Lancaster, Kerrigan is a graduate of St. John's High School in Shrewsbury. A former aide to Senator Edward M. Kennedy, he is president and CEO of the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center, which has sites in Worcester, Framingham, and Milford. He was the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor in 2014 on the ticket with gubernatorial candidate Martha Coakley. He opened a campaign for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in 2018, but dropped out before the election. Kerrigan was elected chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party in April 2023. Passengers will soon have to scan a valid ticket to enter the MBTA commuter rail platform at Ruggles Station in Boston. The MBTA said newly installed fare gates at the station will be operational in August. The move comes as the agency steps up fare enforcement efforts across the system. Currently, anyone can walk onto the train platform at Ruggles with or without a ticket, and then, once aboard, conductors typically check tickets at each seat. This was also the case at South Station until fare gates were installed in late 2025, and at North Station until they were installed in 2022. The MBTA said it is implementing fare gates for each Boston commuter rail station for a more consistent fare-paying experience across transit modes. At South Station, M-ticket activations have increased by 32% from last July, and onboard ticket sales have increased by 16% for lines serving the station since the gate's installation, the MBTA noted. The installation of commuter rail fare gates at Ruggles is just the next step by the MBTA as we follow through on our commitment to improve fare collection and reinvest back into the system that our riders depend on, MBTA General Manager and CEO Philip Eng said in a statement. The new fare gates at Ruggles will begin operating on Monday, August 3rd, the MBTA said. The station will have 7 fare gates, including 2 wider gates that allow space for wheelchairs, scooters, bicycles, luggage, and strollers to pass through. Fare gates at Back Bay are slated to be installed and begin operating in early 2027, according to the agency. Passengers can use an M-ticket, Charlie card, Charlie ticket, paper ticket, Amtrak ticket, or active military ID to get through the fare gates at Ruggles Station. Children 11 and under can still ride the MBTA for free, and their accompanying adult can ask a staff member to open the gate. The fare gates do not accept contactless payment with debit or credit cards, or with phones using a mobile wallet. While the MBTA commuter rail fare gates offer similarly to subway fare gates, they require passengers to scan their commuter rail and Amtrak tickets, both upon entering and exiting the platform area. This means if you purchase a ticket while traveling inbound to Ruggles, you will need to scan it at a fare gate to exit the station once you get there, according to the MBTA. While the fare gates are an additional way to ensure riders pay for tickets, passengers will still have to show their tickets on board the train so conductors can verify their ticket zone, the MBTA said. Johnson Brunetti, an independent retirement and investment specialty firm, has relocated its Franklin office to a larger space at 1 Fisher Street, according to a community announcement. The new office opened Wednesday, July 15th, and replaces a previous one in Franklin Village Plaza, off West Central Street, Route 140. The new 2,754-square-foot office includes 5 conference rooms, up from 2 at the former site, creating additional space for client appointments, educational programs, and team collaboration, according to the announcement. Johnson Brunetti said its Franklin workforce has increased from 4 employees to 15 in the past 5 years. The larger office is intended to support continued growth and serve clients in Franklin and surrounding communities. Our new Franklin office gives us room to continue growing while preserving the personal, local service our clients have come to expect, said David Shapiro, Regional Director of Wealth at Johnson Brunetti, in a statement. The additional meeting and conference space will allow us to serve clients more comfortably while giving our team an environment where we can continue to work collaboratively. Besides Franklin, Johnson Brunetti has Massachusetts offices in Needham, Norwell, and Woburn, according to the announcement. The firm provides retirement and investment guidance through educational workshops, individual consultations, and ongoing financial planning services. Our team's commitment to building meaningful relationships with clients has helped make this growth possible, Shapiro said. This move represents another investment in our employees, our clients, and the Franklin community. Walnut Hills School for the Arts, a private boarding and day arts high school in Natick, has named Craig Sellers as interim head of school, effective August 3rd, according to a community announcement. The appointment follows a board-led search process and comes as the school continues to search for a permanent leader. Walnut Hills' last permanent head of school was Eric Barber, who left in late June after 4 years on the job. Linda Dennison is currently acting head of school. Sellers will guide the school over the next 2 years, bringing more than 2 decades of experience in independent school leadership, according to the announcement. We are thrilled to welcome Craig Sellers to Walnut Hill, said Deb Mankiw and Nicole Gakidis, co-chairs of the Board of Trustees, in a statement. His deep knowledge of independent school administration, coupled with his collaborative leadership style and genuine appreciation for Walnut Hill's unique mission, make him exceptionally well-suited to serve as our interim head. Sellers has held 3 long-term head of school positions and served in 3 interim assignments, according to the announcement. He most recently worked with New Garden Friends School in Greensboro, North Carolina, and previously served at Idlewild Arts Academy in California. Sellers has contributed to National Association of Independent Schools publications. In his 2025 article, the strategic interim head has been widely shared among school leaders, according to the announcement. He holds degrees from Teachers College at Columbia University, New York Law School, and Franklin and Marshall College. Andre Lazarus, a 22-year-old Emerson College theater student, strummed a psychedelically painted acoustic guitar plugged into an amplifier at 9 p.m. on a Saturday. As the guitarist swayed and bounced to his music, scores of 20-somethings screamed along and clapped, not an unusual sight on a summer weekend. But the crowd wasn't standing in front of a stage at a traditional concert venue. They were passengers aboard an MBTA Red Line train. Two other guitarists, Tristan Liu of UMass Boston and Jamie Wang of Berklee College of Music, joined him while Adrian Alvarado, also of Berklee, pounded away on drums, turning a subway car into a makeshift concert venue. Named for its frontman, the four-piece band Lazarus captivated passengers aboard the Braintree-bound train on July 18th. The group played familiar favorites such as Stand By Me by Benny King and Are You Gonna Be My Girl by Jet, while weaving in some of its own original songs, including a grungy rock tune called Beauty Salon. The train bumped along through South Station, Broadway, Andrew, and JFK/UMass, the artists continuing their set as the subway doors opened to let passengers on and off. Lazarus, the band's lead singer, put on an unbridled show, despite the unconventional stage. The rising college senior flashed rock and roll hand gestures, break danced, and even flipped while holding onto the subway straps, earning a roar from the audience. "We want people to get off their phones and dance and meet people and cause a community," Lazarus said in an interview after his performance. "That's what we want to bring back." Lazarus and his bandmates formed the group in December and have since played shows on the train, on Boston Common, along Newbury Street, and at Mojo, a new music festival held at Boston City Hall Plaza this past May. "We're performing as much as we can," he said. "We do free shows and we want to entertain the college scene and everybody." The band's sound blends rock and roll, funk, and blues, drawing inspiration from artists like James Brown and Mick Jagger, Lazarus said. The frontman's vocals carry a raspy edge, bolstering the group's gritty vibe. "This is what I want to do for the rest of my life," Lazarus said of his music. After Lazarus took a bow at the end of the Red Line set, he wiped the sweat from his face, then helped his bandmates load their instruments and equipment into a canvas cart. Some enchanted passengers asked him for photos and shook his hand before the group exited the Red Line train at Quincy Center. "Let's move to another train," Lazarus told his band, as they waited on the platform for the next train to Alewife. Hopkinton has had 20 people apply to become its next police chief, according to Select Board member Matt Kisner. Kisner, a member of the town's Police Chief Screening Committee, provided an update on Tuesday, July 21st, during a Select Board meeting on the progress to find somebody to replace Joseph Bennett, who retired on June 30th. Scott Van Ralton is serving as interim police chief. Kisner said 20 people originally applied for the job, but one has since dropped out, leaving 19. He said the screening committee has reviewed 10 resumes, with the other 9 to be reviewed Thursday. After reviewing all 19 resumes, the candidates, whom the screening committee believes are most qualified, will be moved to the next round, Kisner said. He said they hope to move 8 to 13 of them forward. "We're nowhere near saying a person is a preferred candidate to be police chief of Hopkinton," Kisner said. "The next step will be written and oral tests. From there, a to-be-determined number of top candidates would be moved to an assessment center, likely in late August or early September, to narrow the list down to finalists interviewed by the Select Board. Bennett served 6 years as chief and 33 overall as a Hopkinton police officer. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office on Wednesday, July 22nd, released the name of the victim of Monday's fatality at Foss Reservoir in Framingham. Adama Sow, 18, was a Waltham resident. Sow and several others were jumping from a train trestle at the reservoir, located between Route 9 and the Massachusetts Turnpike, at about 12:15 p.m. Monday, when Sow did not come up from underwater. Friends called 911, and members of the responding dive team located Sow an hour or so later, about 50 feet from the trestle and about 15 feet underwater. He was transported to Metro West Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. The Foss Reservoir is managed by the State Department of Conservation and Recreation. Although swimming is prohibited there, police said the trestle has long been a popular spot for young people to dive into the reservoir. According to the Waltham Times, Waltham Superintendent of Schools Marissa Mendoza said Sal was a student athlete who was a 2026 Waltham High School graduate, and that counselors would be at the school on Wednesday. "This loss is deeply felt throughout our school community," Mendoza said in a statement. "Adama's passing is heartbreaking, and we extend our sincerest condolences to his loved ones, friends, classmates, teachers, and everyone whose life was touched by him. She also urged members of the school community to reach out to each other and to share their thoughts and emotions. The strength of our community is found in how we come together during moments of profound sadness, and I know we will continue to care for one another in the days and weeks ahead, Mendonca said. Jason DeFalco, superintendent of Marlboro Public Schools, recently received the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents Dr. Christos Daoulas Award for outstanding service to the association and the profession. After serving 6 months as Marlboro's interim superintendent, the interim tag was removed from DeFalco's title in January, according to a community announcement. He previously spent 7 years as superintendent of the Blackstone Millville Regional School District and has also held leadership roles in New Bedford, Worcester, Somerville, and Southbridge Public Schools. Mary Bork, executive director of the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents, presented the award during the Paul J. Andrews Executive Institute in Mashpee. Jason navigates complex challenges with wisdom and compassion, Bork said in a statement. Through humility, strong core values centered on belonging, and a steadfast commitment to ensuring that education remains the great equalizer, he exemplifies the very best of the superintendent profession. I am deeply humbled and honored to receive this recognition, DeFalco said. It is a true privilege to serve the students of Massachusetts alongside such dedicated educators and inspiring leaders. According to the announcement, DeFalco has been active in the association for 13 years and played a key role in its racial equity, diversity, and inclusion initiative. He also has served on several committees and statewide education advisory groups. DeFalco holds a bachelor's degree from Suffolk University, a master's degree from Worcester State University, and a doctorate in education from Johnson & Wales University. The award honors Christos Daoulas, longtime superintendent from 1962 to 2000 of Dracut Public Schools, and is presented annually to a superintendent recognized for outstanding leadership and communication. Students seeking a grade 8 seat for the 2026-27 school year at Benjamin Franklin Classical Charter Public School in Franklin can now submit applications, with enrollment remaining open through Monday, August 10th. Benjamin Franklin Classical Charter Public School, a regional public charter school serving students in grades K through 8, has reopened its grade 8 application period, according to a community announcement. The school, which opened in 1995, offers a comprehensive academic program that includes core subjects along with instruction in art, music, languages, technology, and physical education. Students in grades 6 through 8 also participate in weekly classical enrichment courses and receive instruction in French and Latin, according to the announcement. Middle school students are eligible to participate in the school's spring musical. Students in grades 5 through 8 also may take part in overnight field trips held each spring. Grade 8 students typically travel to Washington, D.C. during the week before April vacation, according to the announcement. Round-trip bus transportation is available with bus stops in Bellingham, Blackstone, Franklin, Mendon, Medway, Milford, Millis, Norfolk, and Wrentham. Families interested in enrolling a student in grade 8 can find application materials and enrollment information through the school's website at bfccps.org. Questions about enrollment or the school's educational mission can be directed to Communication Coordinator Joanne Basile at jbasile@bfccps.org. or by calling 508-541-3434, extension 104. You've been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
When someone you know is struggling with vision loss, it can be challenging. But the Mass Commission for the Blind is here to help. We'll connect them to resources that will help them plan for the future with new skills and assistive technology. Find out if they're eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.